Have you ever wondered who the first person was to climb out of a flying airplane and walk on the wing? I'm Taildragger. This is the Hangar On Radio Hangar, and today we're heading back to a time when the entire idea of what you could do with an airplane was still being invented on the fly, sometimes literally. The answer to that question is a young carpenter and house painter from Greenville, Texas, named Ormer Leslie Locklear. And the story of how he got there doesn't start with a Hollywood contract or a barnstorming troupe or a crowd of 10,000 people staring up at the sky with their necks bent back. It starts with a rattling radiator cap on a Curtis Jenny over a training field outside Fort Worth in 1917. And what happened next would change the way America looked at aviation forever. But first, let me tell you about today's sponsor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, pull up a chair. In 1917, the United States was mobilizing for a war it had been watching from a distance for 3 years. The Army Signal Corps had an aviation section, and they needed pilots, and they needed them fast. Thousands of men answered the call, men who had never so much as sat inside an airplane, men who would be soloing within weeks of their first lesson. One of them was Ormer Locklear, 25 years old, a Texas boy who had been fascinated by airplanes since the Wright brothers put theirs in the newspapers. He had watched early flyers as a child, had pressed up against ropes at county fairs, had run across fields toward the sound of an engine. When the Army offered him a chance to fly, he did not hesitate. He trained at Barron Field near Fort Worth, learning to fly the Curtiss JN-4, which everyone in the service called the Jenny. The Jenny was the workhorse of early American aviation. A two-seat biplane, fabric over spruce with a 90-horsepower Curtiss Ox 5 engine under the cowling. That engine put out about as much power as a modern riding lawnmower. It cruised at 60 miles per hour, it landed at 45, and it had a reputation for being honest and forgiving in the air, which is exactly what you want when you're turning civilians into military pilots in a hurry. The cockpit smelled like castor oil and hot metal, and the faint sweetness of doped fabric. The wind at 60 miles per hour was not a gentle thing when all you had between you and it was a pair of goggles and a leather flying helmet. The horizon bounced with every thermal. The controls were heavy and direct, no hydraulics, just cables and pulleys and the feel of the air transmitted directly through your hands. There was nothing between the pilot and the sky but a thin shell of wood and fabric. Locklear took to it immediately. He had the feel for it, the way certain people have a feel for horses or for water. He became an instructor at Barron Field, teaching other men how to handle the Jenny. And by all accounts, he was patient with his students and genuinely at home in the airplane. He was the kind of pilot who seemed most himself when he was in the air. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Curtiss Jenny had a design quirk. The radiator cap, which sat up on the engine cowling, had a tendency to work itself loose in flight. When that happened, coolant began to escape, and a Jenny engine without coolant is a very unhappy engine. You couldn't always land immediately, you dealt with it. The way you dealt with it, if you were flying with a passenger, was you sent him forward. You got a stable attitude, throttled back, and the man in the front cockpit climbed out of his seat, moved forward along the fuselage, and tightened the cap. Simple as that. If you were flying solo, that was a more complicated problem. Locklear, at some point in 1917, was flying solo when the cap started rattling, and instead of landing, he climbed out. He got up out of the rear cockpit, steadied himself against the slipstream, moved forward along the outside of the fuselage, and tightened the cap. While the airplane was flying, while the propeller was turning, while the ground was 2,000 feet below him. Now, nobody told him that was possible. Nobody had written a procedure for it. He just understood in some instinctive way that the airplane in level flight with the throttle eased back would stay in the air long enough for a careful man to do what needed doing. When he got back in the cockpit and landed, he didn't treat it as a near-death experience. He treated it as information. He told his buddies. His buddies didn't entirely believe him, so he did it again. On purpose this time, with witnesses. Word spread around Barron Field, the way interesting things spread around any military base, fast and with embellishment. Some officers were not pleased, but the enlisted men loved it, and Locklear loved the reaction. He brought in two partners, fellow lieutenants named Milton Elliott and James Sloan. Elliott, who everyone called Skeets, was slender and quick, and had a fearlessness that matched Locklear's own. The two of them started working through what was possible, pushing out from the simple act of moving along the fuselage into territory nobody had mapped before. Standing on the upper wing, hanging by the ankles from the landing gear, moving from the lower wing to the upper in flight, doing a handstand on the fuselage while the airplane banked through a turn. They worked out which handholds would hold and which ones would give way without warning. They learned how the slipstream differed at different points along the airplane, where it would press you flat against the fabric and where it would try to throw you clear of the aircraft entirely. They worked out signals between the man on the wing and the man in the cockpit. Hand signals, foot signals, the kind of wordless communication that builds between two people who have made a habit of trusting each other with their lives.
Because if that trust broke, if the pilot made a move the wing walker wasn't expecting, there was no recovery. These men understood that. They kept flying anyway. By the time the war ended in November of 1918, Locklear and Skeets Elliott had developed a routine that was genuinely extraordinary. Transfers between two aircraft in flight, moving from one Jenny to another while both airplanes were airborne, with the pilot of each holding a precise course and altitude, hanging by the hands from a rope ladder trailing from the landing gear, lying flat on the upper wing through a loop, held in place by nothing but grip and nerve while the earth and sky traded places. The war was over. The government had thousands of Jennies it didn't need anymore. You could buy one for a couple of $100s if you knew the right people and could get to the right surplus sale. And America was restless. You have to understand the 1920s through the eyes of someone who had just watched an entire generation go to Europe and not all come back. There was energy everywhere, a hunger for novelty and color and things that had never been seen before. Motion pictures were drawing crowds to theaters in every town. Radio was crackling into existence. And here were these young veterans with airplanes and the kind of skill and nerve that only comes from doing something dangerous long enough to get good at it. Locklear, Elliott, and a rotating cast of daredevils formed a troop and started working their way across the country. The formula was straightforward: fly into a town, land in a farmer's field, get the local newspaper to run a notice, and wait for the crowd to build. Charge a quarter to watch, charge a dollar or two for a ride, split the take, move on. The shows drew thousands. Farmers drove wagons in from 10 miles out. Town shopkeepers closed up for the afternoon, children climbed fence posts for a better view. The smell of exhaust drifted across the grass, and that engine sound, that particular clatter of the Ox 5 at full throttle, stopped every conversation underneath it.
Locklear understood showmanship the way certain people just understand rhythm. He knew how to build an act. He knew the value of the pause before the payoff, that moment of held breath that made the crowd feel the danger before the stunt arrived. He understood that the 10 seconds of nothing before a transfer was as important as the transfer itself. He read the crowd the way a musician reads a room, gave them a little less than they wanted, then gave them everything. He also knew, better than anyone, what made it all work. That it was real, not a trick, not an illusion. A man, actually on the upper wing of an airplane, actually in the air, held in place by grip and balance and nothing else. The crowd could feel the difference. You always can. Hollywood noticed. The film industry in 1919 was hungry for images that would stop a theater cold, things that could not be faked and could not be looked away from. Universal Pictures offered Locklear a contract. He made his first film, The Great Air Robbery, in 1919. The story involved stolen airmail and aerial pursuit, and the flying sequences were entirely authentic. No camera tricks, no process shots. Locklear and his crew performed in the actual sky, and the cameras on the ground caught all of it. And audiences sat in darkened theaters from coast to coast and watched things happen in the real air that they could not quite believe were possible. The film was a success. Universal wanted a second picture. Locklear called it The Skywayman. They began production in the summer of 1920. The script called for a climactic sequence, a nighttime dive, the airplane spiraling down out of a dark California sky, searchlights sweeping up to catch it as it came. They would film it at a field near Los Angeles on the night of August 2, 1920.
I want you to picture that night. A hot California evening, the kind of heat that doesn't release even after the sun goes down, the kind where the air smells like dry grass and dust and motor oil. The camera crews set up on the ground. The searchlight operators got their positions and their instructions. Locklear and Skeets Elliott climbed into their Jenny, buckled in, and ran through whatever, passed for a pre-flight check in 1920. The engine caught, the Ox 5 warmed up, that distinctive clatter settling into a steady rhythm. They taxied out into the dark. They climbed, 2,000 feet, maybe more, and then they dove. The searchlights found them as they came down, the beams sweeping up and locking onto the descending airplane. And this is where the accounts disagree, and the night becomes irreversible. Some witnesses said the searchlights blinded Locklear, that coming down in that spiral with the beams full in his eyes, he lost the horizon, lost his reference, lost the sense of where the ground was until it was too close to matter. Others said the maneuver was simply too low,
that the speed they had built in the dive left no altitude for the recovery. What is not in dispute, the Jenny did not pull out. Ormer Locklear and Skeets Elliott died in that field on August 2, 1920. Locklear was 28 years old. The cameras were still rolling when they hit the ground. Universal released the Skywayman anyway. The film drew enormous crowds. People came to see the picture of the man who died making it.
I've thought about that for a long time, and I still don't know entirely what to do with it. The American appetite for spectacle, for things that are real and dangerous and irreversible, is something we've never fully reckoned with as a culture. Locklear understood it better than most, understood it well enough to build a career out of it, and in the end it was that same appetite that put the searchlights in the field that night and shaped the dive that the script demanded. But here's what I want to leave you with. The barnstorming era that Locklear helped ignite continued for 15 years after his death. The stunts he worked out at Barron Field in 1917 were standard features of traveling air shows by the middle of the decade. Whole troops organized around wing walking and aerial transfers, with specialty performers and polished routines and promoters who knew how to work the local press. More than that, those barnstormers were doing something no government program and no aviation booster could have accomplished on its own. They were landing in places where the nearest city was 100 miles away, and they were putting an airplane directly in front of people who had never stood next to one, and they were offering rides. And tens of thousands of Americans climbed into a Jenny because a barnstormer landed near their town. Some of those people became pilots, some became engineers. Some just became people who loved airplanes for the rest of their lives and taught their children to look up whenever they heard an engine overhead. Charles Lindbergh barnstormed before he ever thought about the Atlantic. Jimmy Doolittle's love of flying traces back to air shows he watched as a boy. Amelia Earhart took her first airplane ride in a barnstormer's Jenny and was a licensed pilot within 6 months. The Curtiss Jenny sits quiet in museums now, the fabric faded, the Ox-5 cold behind glass. If you ever find yourself standing next to one, look at how small it is. Look at the thin fabric stretched over those wooden ribs. Look at the open cockpit with the little wind deflector that did almost nothing against 60 miles per hour of slipstream. And think about a carpenter from Greenville, Texas, who crawled out onto that wing at 2,000 feet because the radiator cap was loose and discovered something nobody had known before, that the air, if you were careful enough, would hold you. My thanks to the National Air and Space Museum, Film History Archives of the Silent Era, and historical accounts of the barnstorming years that have kept these stories from being lost. More at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. We'll see you next time.